Good afternoon, America. Welcome to the Raucous Caucus. This is Mark Levine, broadcasting to you live from We Act Radio Studios right here in Anacostia. We're going to get Terry on the line in just a second. We've got two main issues to talk about today. One is the Supreme Court deciding that it's going to hear marriage cases, cases of marriage equality. This is something that people have been wondering when the United States Supreme Court is going to squarely address the question of whether or not gay Americans have the same rights as straight Americans to get married. And we're going to talk about fiscal cliff. I know Terry definitely wants to focus on that because that's, of course, the big question that's going on in Washington.
I want to talk about the fact that we should jump off the fiscal cliff.
Yeah, basically, you want to be, what was it, Louise and Terry, what's her name? Oh, Teresa, what? I forgot now. Who went over the cliff? Come on, you're my cultural historian here.
You're the living heck out of me. I don't know about
our listeners. You know what? Thelma and Louise, not Terry and Louise.
Maybe you were
going off the cliff. I thought, no, it's Thelma. Thelma.
Yeah.
Excuse me, I got you confused with Thelma.
Yeah, right, so many people do.
I understand. Thelma, Terry wants to do a little Thelma and Louise trick and go off the fiscal cliff, and I'm actually weirdly agree with him, but we'll get to that in the second part of the show. The first part of the show, though, deals with the Supreme Court finally deciding to decide to bring this question to the national stage. Now, there's two main things they're going to decide, and let's be clear what they're doing here. One is the Defense of Marriage Act, and the other is California's Proposition 8. So let's go through quickly the legalities of each of these. The Defense of Marriage Act is basically federal recognition of state marriages. So there actually is no place in the United States of America where gay people actually have the right to get married, because even in states like Massachusetts and Maryland and just recently in Washington State, D.C., Vermont, Connecticut, the nine states in D.C. that have it, they only give state rights, the rights under state law. But there's all kinds of rights under federal law. For example, Social Security benefits. If you die, your spouse gets survivor benefits, but not if you're gay. Military benefits go to spouses, but not if you're gay. Federal state taxes. If you die and you pass on to your spouse, there's actually no tax whatsoever, no matter how rich you are, but not if you're gay. If you're gay, you pay higher taxes because the federal government doesn't recognize state marriages when the couples are gay. Now, this is something that was passed before actually there was legal same-sex marriage. It occurred back in 1996, believe it or not, under Bill Clinton. At the time, it was paired with the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, which, by the way, fell by one vote. Today, that would pass easily. It says that the government can't discriminate against gay people in the workforce. But at the time, Bill Clinton felt he needed it to win re-election in 1996. Obviously, I'm not a fan of it, but I'm just trying to give you the context of the time, and I think we've come a long way since 1996. So that's one of the two things. The other thing is California's Proposition 8, where the Supreme Court of California said that it was against the California Constitution to prohibit gay people from marrying. And the people of California back in, I think it's 04 now, it seems like a long time ago, they had a very, very close vote to say to take away that right. I don't think California would vote the same way either. I think there's been a dramatic change. But both these questions are coming up before the U.S. Supreme Court. What say you, Terry?
Mark, what's fascinating to me more than anything else regarding this issue, and I don't know if the courts will reflect this, only 4 years ago, about 39% of Americans were in favor of basically of, of allowing same-sex marriage, et cetera. And since then, just in 4 years, now it's 49%.
Right.
And an overwhelming majority, because it's 40% that still oppose it. So this is a huge and excellent, cultural shift. And
quick, too. I mean, racial equality has changed certainly over the last 50 years. Most white Americans, many supported segregation in the 50s and 60s. Certainly most don't today. But that's a change that took place over a generation or two.
Yeah.
I can't think of the right of women to vote, again, began in the 1880s, took to 1920, took a good, 40 years. I don't think I've ever seen a cultural movement happen this quickly. I mean, this is happening in 10 years.
Yeah, and that amazing shift. And to me, I find this, culturally and politically encouraging, because it indicates, the purpose of our Constitution, frankly, the purpose of our country, the Declaration, our Constitution, is to promote equality. And we stray from that like like crazy. We really do, particularly economically. But there has been enormous progress, and it's been rough progress. I mean, into civil war, you know, up through the civil rights movements, you know, women's suffrage. It takes, in a way, forever, but it's moving faster and faster, and it's moving in bolder and bolder ways. And sooner or later, I think we will actually, because of this, particularly, it'll be interesting to see what happens with the Supreme Court decision here, you know, begin to approach some kind of discussion of economic inequality as well.
That would be the last gasp, given all the Republicans' complaints about, you know, socialist Obama, when Obama is really a very, very moderate politician and nowhere even close to socialism. But getting back to this cultural shift, mm-hmm. Here's what I find so interesting. The clear difference is among youth and the elderly. It's there's tiny differences among black and white and Latino, but they're really very small. There's certainly major differences whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, but that's sort of self-selection. If you support gay rights, you're more likely to be a Democrat. If you don't, you're more likely to be a Republican. But the clear, absolute demarcation in this is age. There's a fascinating poll where they looked at not just age. I mean, clearly, the vast majority of Americans under 40 are fine with it. The vast majority of Americans over 60 are against it. But here's the poll I found most interesting. I saw a poll that showed all 50 states based on age. In the most conservative state, the most anti-gay rights state in the United States was Alabama. Okay. In Alabama, something like 70-80% of the population was against same-sex marriage. But among people under 30 in Alabama, 55% supported it. Now, let me give you another statistic that may even more surprise you. In Massachusetts, it's the most pro-gay rights state in the United States. Some 70-75% support same-sex marriage. And in Massachusetts, if you look at people over 60, only 35% supported marriage equality. So what you have here is, as distinct as Alabama and Massachusetts are, and obviously in Massachusetts, 90% of the young people were for it, and in Alabama, you know, 10% of the elderly were for it. I mean, that makes sense. But you find that the elderly of Massachusetts are less progressive on this issue than the young people of Alabama. And I found that fascinating, even a little bit shocking, given the differences between Alabama and Massachusetts.
I don't find it shocking because, I mean, the reality is, and thank heavens, I'm just getting younger and younger and younger.
You are.
Yeah, you know. So I
ever since the days of George Washington, you're young again.
Yes, yes. But it's a natural process, and somehow there's a sensitivity there that probably should be observed. I mean, the reality is, as people get older, no matter what their situation, they get a little bit more afraid of change. And it's a logical step because, I mean, their life is changing. They're beginning to understand mortality, which young people do not understand. And they're beginning to understand how to live with, you know, end-of-life situations, and they're experiencing it. And to start changing society while they're... You know, while their entire life prospect is changing dramatically, is scary.
See, I look at it differently, Tara. I don't look at it as someone growing older becomes more conservative. I look at it as someone growing older grew up in a different time. If you're over 60 years old, let me do the math. You were born sometime before 1950, and you grew up even in the desegregation era. You grew up with, you know, the 60s. Particularly if you grew up before the great revolutionary changes of the 60s, you're used to a more, of course, America was never that way, but portrayed as a Leave It to Beaver type America. And the idea of gay people getting married is just way just outside your knowledge.
No, I think it has more to do with age.
Let me just say this, because if you're under 30, you grew up in MTV, you grew up in Big Brother, you grew up where Will and Grace, where gay people are all over the place. Your friends are coming out. None of your friends come out when you're over 60. But if you're under 30, your friends came out in high school. You know many gay people, and you're like, why would anyone discriminate? I think it's the cultural difference between when you grew up that explains the political difference. Go ahead.
Well, there's validity in that, to be sure. But you also have to remember, you talk about, you know, people born before 1950 or whatever. Those are the people who really embraced and led in the civil rights movement. And you wouldn't have had the civil rights movement if it weren't for those boomers, you know, that basically supported it politically and socially for the most part, and never would have happened. And it's also the same generation, you know, that probably more boldly than any generation opposed war to a huge degree. So it was a very progressive, you know, generation. And the fact is, as they get older, they get less and less progressive. You know, and
I just think culturally, I got to say, I think Hollywood makes a difference. I think what you see on TV and in the movies makes a difference.
Oh, yes.
And I also think, really, the process of coming out makes a difference. If you came, look, and the laws make a difference, too. It's amazing to me that just 10 years ago, in 2003, all right, before 2003, in 2002, 10 years ago, 13 states could put you in prison for two men or two women having consensual sex. That's amazing to me. It was before Lawrence v. Texas. When I went to law school, Bowers v. Hardwick was the law of the land, which said that Texas could put you in jail for 20 years for sodomy, which, by the way, according to Texas law, would include oral sex between a husband and a wife.
Well, Texas can put you in jail for any reason.
Well, that's true. But my point is,
we're talking about Texas here.
My point is just it's 2003 that the Supreme Court changed its mind on that by a very close vote, 5-4. No, actually, I think it was 6-3. Now I think about it, because like O'Connor was on that side, and the swing vote was Justice Kennedy. And this actually, now I'm coming full circle. The question is, will Justice Kennedy, because I'm quite confident that the four liberals, the two appointed by Clinton, the two appointed by Obama, I'm very, very confident that they're going to support marriage equality. No question about that. But we need a fifth vote. And I think the most likely fifth vote is going to come from that same justice, Anthony Kennedy, who was against us on health care. But Anthony Kennedy, as far as I read him, he's more of a libertarian than a evangelical conservative. In other words, he's a libertarian. He hates government involvement in health care. So he was against Obamacare. Obviously, I disagree with him. But I think on issues like equality, libertarians mostly say, you know, live and let live. They may disagree with government involvement in the economy, but they're not someone to take away individual rights. I actually think we're going to win this battle, both on the Defense of Marriage Act and on California's Proposition 8. I think it's going to it's being close. I'm not making bets with you, Terry, on it, because I'm less
I'm
sure about this.
Big check coming any day when I finally win a
well,
bet.
Well, you know, I'm still waiting for those $3 that you owe me. But
I want you to keep a tab. I really do. You know, I mean, this is like a good bar. Keep a tab.
I'm going to give a prediction that by a 5-4 vote, Anthony Kennedy comes through narrowly. This, by the way, I want to be very clear. This will not mean that gay people have the right to get married nationwide. That's not what these cases are about. The cases are about in the 9 states in D.C. where they can get married, whether they'll have full rights, federal rights and not just state rights, and also the 10th state, California, whether the people have a right to take away these benefits, you know, same-sex equality and marriage equality that they once gave. That one's actually closer. I actually think Defense of Marriage Act is an easier one to fight than the one in California.
You know, interestingly, the attorneys that have filed it, Theodore Olson and David Bois, I think it's Bois. I'm not sure how he pronounces
Bois.
His last name.
Bois.
You know, they based their challenge, they based on Kennedy's decision, majority decision, back when in that previous case.
Right. Well, actually,
so
there were two cases.
I mean, he would have to reverse himself completely to oppose this.
Well, okay. So there's the case I talked about was Lawrence v. Texas. That says you couldn't criminalize consensual acts between sex acts between adults. There's a subsequent case. It's about 07. I may be wrong by a year. It's the Romer v. Evans case. This is a case out of Colorado where mm-hmm. the people of Denver and the people of Boulder, very liberal cities, gave equal rights to gay people. You couldn't discriminate on the basis of jobs or housing, basically a civil rights law. And then the people of Colorado, the entire state is far more conservative than these cities. It includes evangelical bastions like Colorado Springs and so forth. The entire state voted in a close vote to overturn the local protections for gay people. And Kennedy came up with a decision that actually surprised me at the time, again, 5-4, where he said, nope, well, you can't take away a minority's civil rights. You can't have a popular vote to remove a minority civil rights. And so those local laws in Colorado were reinstated. David Bois and Ted Olson argue that this case for Proposition 8 in California is exactly the same as the case in Colorado. And they're appealing right to Anthony Kennedy to do that.
So and I think it's a very wise strategy, to be sure. You know, and it is significant. I mean, I was reading the other day about it that one doesn't really understand how far the Marriage Act of 1996 extends, but Section 3 of the law, actually, which defines marriage as between only a man and a woman, and this is for the purposes of over 1,000 federal laws and programs that that law affects. Now, if that isn't discrimination, you know, I don't know what the heck it is to have a law that says these two people, because they happen to be gay and they happen to be female or male, you know, in the same sex, those people are not going to be served by over 1,000 laws and programs of the federal government. I mean, that's ridiculous.
Well, it's also because people, I don't think most Americans realize that there is no real marriage equality, even in Massachusetts. I mean, we celebrated what happened in Maryland and in Washington State, and of course all those states in New England, New York. We celebrated that, but that, well, even that wasn't marriage equality. It was half. It was the state rights, and there's about 1,000 state benefits, so it's significant. But there's another, as you point out, another 1,000 federal benefits, and that's what the Defense of Marriage Act, you know, needs to get rid of. And by the way, to Obama's credit, the president ran on the fact that he felt that the Defense of Marriage Act was unconstitutional, and he's fulfilled that promise. His Justice Department, the Attorney General, Eric Holder, is not defending the law. Now, normally, even if the president doesn't like a law, as long as he thinks it's constitutional, he's required to execute the laws to defend the laws. In this case, the president has said this law is not constitutional, and his Attorney General, his Solicitor General, he's actually number two in the Justice Department. They're the, that's the person who fights battles before the Supreme Court. I'm trying to remember who it is now. It used to be Elena Kagan, but she's now on a justice. His Solicitor General is actually arguing it is not constitutional. And so in order to find someone who would defend the law, the Republicans in the House of Representatives have appointed a guy, a former Solicitor General under George W. Bush, a guy by the name of Paul Clement, very talented litigator, and he's going to argue that it is constitutional because the president himself will not defend this law, and good for Obama on that.
Well, I mean, what can be the defense? I mean, you can explain this probably better than I, but what can be the expense, Mark, that any of these laws are constitutional? I mean, they are, you know, deliberately focusing on a particular group of people and saying, no, you don't have equal rights. How can the Constitution, our Constitution, possibly justify that?
Well, on the Defense of Marriage Act, there's even a broader basis than that, and that is that there's simply no power of Congress to regulate marriage. I mean, here's what's so interesting. For 200 years, the states have regulated marriage, and that's why some states you can marry your first cousin, some states you can't marry your first cousin, some states in the South you can marry someone who's 14 or 16, other states required to be 18. There are differences among the states with regard to marriage. They may be considered minor for most cases, but there are those differences, and the federal government has never regulated any of them. I know at the time when it was illegal for blacks and whites to get married, in the very famous case of Loving v. Virginia, the Lovings got married in D.C. because it was legal in D.C. and it wasn't legal in Virginia. And everyone understood that each state, or in this case, I'm looking at D.C. as a state, they can regulate it differently. The Constitution, conservatives always say, the Constitution has limited federal powers. They were constantly saying, you know, you can't do this with Obamacare. They were wrong in Obamacare because Congress can promote the general welfare and things like that. I don't know how these laws promote the general welfare. But there's nothing in the federal Constitution about regulating marriage. So I think there's a very strong separation of powers argument. Just that alone defeats the Defense of Marriage Act. And then, of course, there is the 14th Amendment, which you point out, Terry, which is the broader question. Of course, I would argue on the 14th Amendment, every state has to allow same-sex marriage. And that, I think, is coming, but I think that's more 5-10 years down the road. That's not what's going to be decided in this case.
I want to back up one little bit because this is something I didn't know, Mark. Is there a state that allows marriage to 14-year-olds?
I believe so. I believe in the South. I believe in the South. It may be 16. I mean, I haven't done the research because I haven't really planned to marry on a 14-year-old. So
well, I'm glad to hear that.
I guarantee you, Terry, at one time it was legal. Maybe 50 years ago it was legal. I don't know if it's still legal today. I'll tell you what, I'll do research in the break and I'll find that out for you.
Yeah, because I mean, if that's true, then, you know, Jerry Lee Lewis shouldn't have been picked on for marrying that. I guess she was only 13 when he married her.
Also, some of those states require parental permission.
Yeah.
You know, like I guess you get your shotgun out and you say, you got my daughter pregnant. You got it. They tend to be in the South. I'm going to research that when we come back. We also have a caller when we come back. So we're going to take a break and we'll take our caller and then we'll move on to Terry's issue of whether we go Thelma and Louise on the fiscal cliff. So plenty to talk about. If you want to join the discussion, it's 202-889-9797. 202-889-9797. This is Mark Levine and Terry DeKester. We are the Raucous Caucus, and we will be right back right after this.
TWC, We Act Radio, 1480 AM, weactradio.com.
Welcome back to the Raucous Caucus. This is Mark Levine here with
Terry D. Kester, the Doctor of Democracy.
And we are the Raucous Caucus, and we are taking your calls at 202-889-9797. And Terry, before we get to your topic, going off the fiscal cliff, although maybe that's what our caller wants to talk about, I'm not sure. We've got Michael from the Bronx, New York, who's becoming a regular caller right here on the Raucous Caucus. Hello, Michael. How are you, sir?
Can you hear me, Mark?
I hear you just fine.
Hello, okay. Michael. How are you?
No, wait, that's Mark. I'm Michael.
All I know, Michael, is if you're expecting a big paycheck from us, we have bad news for you.
I can't even get $3 from Terry, so yeah. it's going to be a problem.
That's funny. Actually, I was calling about the issue you were discussing before the break, and that was regarding the gay marriage.
Yeah.
All right. I just want to state for the record, even though I'm progressive, I'm also Catholic.
Right.
But I will tell you that even Catholics are at odds along this line, as well as even Roe v. Wade. You got progressive Catholics and you got conservative Catholics.
Right. There are all kinds of Catholics. People sometimes assume the Catholics are conservative, and it is worth pointing out that 5 of our 9 justices on the Supreme Court are Catholic. People are always surprised by that. The majority of our Supreme Court is Catholic. But there's people like E.J. Dionne, one of my favorite progressive writers, who's as Catholic as can be and clearly progressive. Heck, Stephen Colbert, when he's not wearing his pretend conservative face, is a progressive Catholic. There's all kinds of progressive Catholics. And my old boss, Congressman Barney Frank, and I have an announcement about him that's coming up at the end of the hour, by the way. I'm going to get to that in a second. But he will tell me that his district in Massachusetts had a very heavy Catholic population, and Catholics tend to be more progressive than Protestants in America, so they shouldn't all be considered as conservative. Anyway, go ahead, Michael. Make your point.
Okay. My point is that, once again, the Republicans are going around kicking themselves in the butt because they keep crossing fine lines here. The thing is that this is one of those topics where I've always said, you leave it in a matter, you know, you leave the matter in God's hands, that just like like I said, I'm Catholic, I'm a heterosexual, I'm married to a beautiful wife, but just as I don't want anyone prying into my relationship with my wife and my intimate relationship with my wife, who am I or anyone else to be prying into the personal relationships with anyone else or what goes on behind closed doors? As long as there are no crimes being committed, as long as no one's hurting one another, you respect the rights of others, as well as respecting the right to privacy, and whatever goes on is between the two consenting people and God.
Michael makes a great point. You know, it always amuses me, guys, that those who are opposed to all of these kind of progressive changes regarding individual rights, they always claim states' rights. And at the same time, the states' rights they are always claiming are the rights to suppress people within their own state, which is, you know, totally unconstitutional. And they claim that their states' rights attitude is what the Constitution requires and what America is about, but they use that excuse to discriminate against individuals and never seem to see the contradiction there.
Terry, I've been looking up the age of consent for you because I know you want.
Not for me, no. You're happily married,
but you know, just in case you want to divorce your wife and marry a 14-year-old. Just so you know the rule, it is true that without parental consent, you got to be 18, and it looks like all the 50 states. However, with parental consent, in Alabama, you can marry a 14-year-old. So, Terry, you're going to have to get your parents to agree. But actually,
my parents are dead. How am I going to do this?
Then I guess you can't marry a 14-year-old. Then I really think it's up to her parents to consent.
Oh, okay.
I think that's how it works.
And I seriously doubt my wife is going to let me take a vacation in Alabama for that purpose.
Probably not. But just so you know, those of you who want to marry 14-year-olds, go to Alabama, get the parental consent, and you too can marry a 14-year-old.
I can see a flood of people moving to Alabama immediately, which is not encouraging.
There are other states as well, but that one I remembered. I remembered the 14, so how do you like that? So,
but there's much more to it.
Go ahead.
There's much more to this. The thing also is that you can have 10 households, and this is where Republicans and the right-wingers are playing a very, very dangerous game. You can have 10 households, each having two people of the same gender occupying the household. Only two of the 10 may very well be in an intimate relationship, the same gender intimate relationship, while the other 8 are just roommates that are splitting the cost. Just by looking at these pairs standing in front of their own homes, how would you know which one is gay and which one is not? And the answer is you don't, and you're not supposed to know. And the reason why it's so dangerous is just because you see two people of the same gender residing in the same household, the thing is that a lot of these people are going automatically rush to judgment and say, oh, my, these two people must be gay. We got to do something about it. And then all of a sudden, you're tormenting these people. You're harassing them.
Well,
and the thing goes way out of hand, and then you find out, oh, my God, they're just roommates. But yet
well,
the damage is already done.
Whether they are or they aren't, we need to obviously have laws against harassment. That's one of the reasons we have hate crimes laws. One more thing, and then we're going to switch to Terry's topic.
Yes.
And that is that you mentioned the Catholic Church. It's very important to point out, and I actually worked, I helped draft the D.C. marriage equality law. I'm very proud of the role I played. I worked with Councilman Phil Mendelson, who I think is terrific, to really work out the details. We made it very, very clear that churches, synagogues, mosques, religious institutions can marry whomever they want. It's perfectly fair for a Catholic church to say, we're not marrying non-Catholics, or for a synagogue to say, we're not marrying non-Jews. It's perfect. Heck, a church, and I don't like this, obviously, but a church could discriminate on the basis of race or anything because they have that First Amendment right. We do not affect religious marriages one iota. Some religious institutions do marry gay couples. Most do not. The point is that, because people often confuse these two, it should be very much pointed out that in every one of the 9 states in D.C., churches can marry whomever they want to marry based on whether they're gay or not, based on any other thing, their religion or how they're going to take care of the children, whatever. That those rights are still protected. What we're talking here is civil marriage, the marriage under the state law, and I want to be very, very clear about that distinction. So
that
hang on.
Is-
Hang on with me, Michael, if you would. I want to give Terry his due because it's his time, this second part of the show. And I know, Terry, you want to talk about going off the fiscal cliff.
Oh, it's a good idea. It's
That's
a really good
too.
Idea, and I'm all in favor of it. I mean, actually, to be realistic about it, Mark and Michael, you know, originally when we talked about the fiscal cliff, I think I reacted like most people did, that, you know, this could be terrible and all that, and it could be terrible in a personal situation and, you know, managing my own finances, et cetera, and the market's going to crash and the world's going to go to hell, et cetera. And then I began to realize, if nothing else, once again, the media is hyping something way beyond its legitimate value. Now, there are going to be some problems, to be sure, but I have also read numerous reports by investors, et cetera, that even if it goes through, yes, there will probably be a dip in the market for a while because they'll scream uncertainty again, and the media will play up uncertainty again, so everybody will be uncertain. So there will be a dip, I have no doubt, but they also point out it'll be relatively short-lived. So I don't fear it on that level, and I think it's an illegitimate fear to claim, excuse me, that the market is going to collapse if this happens. The other thing is, I think there's a cultural issue and there's a political issue in this as well as a financial issue. It's also questionable on how much a deficit is a threat to our economy and to our society. And that's one that we basically ignore. And again, I have pointed out to many people before, if you want to get a good perspective on this, look up at the economist Randall Ray, Ray. And the fact that we have this huge deficit, et cetera, is not necessarily as big a problem as it seems. Given even that, the other aspect, and this is what's really struck me in the last few weeks with all the hype and everything else going on about, is there's no other way at this point that Congress is going to act responsibly. Now, in this sense, we're circumventing Congress, but at the very least, It should embarrass Congress to such a degree that they cannot resolve anything around, about this beforehand. They do have the chance, of course, of resolving aspects of it afterwards if it should go through. So my basic feeling on all this, one, it's not going to be a financial disaster. Two, it is a relatively fair way of downsizing, relatively speaking. For instance, with the military, it'll be, what, between 5 to 8%. That they'll have to come down. There's nothing else that's going to make the military come down. It just doesn't happen, you know. So in some ways, it's going to be minor pain. It also is going to be a gradual process in instituting all of this. So it's not going to be over the cliff in one big jump. It's going to be stepping down a step at a time down a steep hill, which really is not going to cause that much damage and may just cause a lot of good.
Let me say why I like where you're coming from, Terry, even though I actually think it would be better if we could avert the cliff on our terms, to be sure, rather than go over it. It's important for people to realize what the cliff is. It's not like what happened in 2011 when the Republicans threatened to fall on the national debt. That was a cliff. That was use your apocalypse, Armageddon, whatever term you want to use for a really, really bad thing. The United States has never defaulted on its debt before, even in the Revolutionary War, even during the Civil War. We have all kinds of nations parking their money here, keeping our interest rates low. That would run away. It would destroy the nation's economy forever. You could almost never say forever. But in this case, you could say forever, because once you default once, it's like you're no longer a virgin anymore, right? I mean, once you're no longer a virgin, once you're no longer a virgin, you are no longer a virgin, period. There is no going back.
Is that true?
I hear that's true. Yes.
Oh, okay.
I hear that's true. It's the same with defaulting on the national debt. You can say the United States has never defaulted on its debt now. You could never, ever say that again. 100 years from now, people would be afraid to park their money in the United States because some crazy Congress might do the same thing the Republicans threaten to do again. That is cliff, Armageddon, apocalypse, etc. That is not what this is. Though, to be clear, one of the things that's part of the negotiations is to avoid this debt crisis, this debt ceiling crisis. One of the things I'm really glad Barack Obama put on the table is to prevent the Republicans from threatening to default on the national debt, because that really is extremely severe crisis. You're right, Terry. This is not that. What this is a fiscal slope, as I've said, not a cliff.
Yep.
It basically, there's 1 year's worth of taxes and spending that has to change. It doesn't have to all happen in January. In fact, it wouldn't. At worst, it would happen, you know, 1/52nd of it every week. But even that doesn't have to happen. In fact, Barack Obama has the authority to order the Treasury Secretary not to even change the tax tables. So he could keep taxes the same while they worked out their details. If they couldn't work it out, they'd have to, you know, backtrack it and raise people's taxes in the latter half. But the heart of what going over the cliff means with regard to tax rates is that the tax rates Republicans have been fighting for 12 years automatically happen, and there ain't nothing they can do about it. And even if somehow they convince 60 senators, I don't know how you do that when there's 55 Democrats in the Senate and Harry Reid's in control, but even if they could convince 60 senators to vote to leave these massive tax cuts for the rich and the House votes for it, President Obama could veto it. Then he'd have to have two-thirds. They simply, the 39.6% rates happen, and there's nothing the Republicans can do about it except to argue right now and to negotiate around it right now. So it's that kind of leverage that the president has. And to his credit, he knows he's got it. I've seen President Obama in the past sometimes when it came to the fall of the national debt, the Republicans had him over a barrel. Now he's got them over a barrel. So whether or not we go over the cliff, as you're talking about, Terry, or whether he uses this leverage threat of going over the cliff to get a really good deal with Republicans, either way, the president's in the driver's seat. Go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, well, this, what you were speaking about, the president having this power, that's that 14th Amendment that some of the media's been talking about.
I talk about that, although I got to tell you, I spoke with Chris Van Hollen. He's the ranking member, Democratic member of the Budget Committee. He's the Paul Ryan on the Democratic side. I spoke with him just 2 days ago about this issue on the air. And I mentioned Section 4 of the 14th Amendment, which says the validity of the public debt authorized by law shall not be questioned. And he put the blame on the president, but he said, well, the president has said they're not going to invoke that. I think that's a mistake. I think that that's something that, again, and I said to Congressman Van Hollen, I said, well, when push comes to shove, please remember this arrow in your quiver. It would be an extraordinary thing because he's basically saying all those laws about debt ceilings are just irrelevant. And I think it's definitely something that should be a last resort. But I think you should keep that in mind because better than the United States defaulting would be applying the Constitution. So I keep pointing that out. You're absolutely right, Michael.
But,
go ahead.
But I think it's also important for everyone to know that the president does reserve the right to change course if indeed necessary. He knows, and everybody knows, nothing is ever absolute. And I don't think he wants to go that route to the 14th Amendment. But remember, if he does go that route, it's because the Republicans pushed him
right
to having to go that
route. I think that's got to be the last redoubt. You know, you look at a battle. I don't know if you ever studied like warfare, the way you have sort of like an outer line and then middle line and then the inner line protecting the castle or whatever, the fort. I think that's the last protection. If the Republicans really start to default on the national debt, then when President Obama pulls out his Constitution and says, now, hold on, we've got the 14th Amendment here. And think about what that would do. The president simply just ignores them. It might go to the courts, but I think it's highly unlikely that the Supreme Court, particularly Justice Roberts, is going to say, all right, I'm going to force the United States to not pay its debts and to cause cataclysmic worldwide recession. Justice Roberts, I don't think he's got the I think he's someone who would not want to cross that line. Go ahead, Terry.
Well, the bigger question, you know, in this is, you know, is this nation ever going to get honest about the economic situation in this country? I forget who it was, but an economist pointed out recently that what we really should do, first off, is get rid of the income tax entirely. And the point that they were making is there are so many definitions now of what income is by in the, 70,000 pages of the income tax laws, that nobody can really figure out what to do with our tax system. And it's so destructive and so complex, and it has become an industry in and of itself just to try to understand the darn thing, that we can't realistically deal with our situation economically, period. A perfect example of that is a bit simplistic, but as Republicans, of course, always screaming, you know, that we have the highest, you know, the tax rate on, it's not income tax, but the highest tax rate on
corporations
and on businesses of any country in the world, you know, in a Western country anyway. Well, that's true if you go by the numbers, but if you work into the exclusions and all of the loopholes, we have one of the lowest.
That's right. They pay like
6%. So there's nothing that is honest about our financial situation. It is all sort of a scam that is being perpetrated on the people without definition, without clarity. And so nobody really knows exactly what to do with the economy. And hopefully, my point is, if we have this cliff, it'll be a go over this cliff or this slope, it'll be kind of a wake-up call that we really do have to look at what is the American economy, how is it manipulated, and how do we get it to somehow to serve the people instead of the few.
And here's what's shocking is that in this case, Terry, you and the far right agree. I mean, this is something that one of the weird ways that the left, the right, the center, the moderates, the conservatives, the liberals, the socialists, we can all come together and say that our tax reform is a mess, that it helps special interests, that it's got way too many loopholes. When Boehner says get rid of loopholes, I say go Boehner. We're fine with that. Now, the devil's in the details. Which loopholes does Boehner want to get rid of? Well, loopholes that help single mothers, loopholes that help poor people have a chance to succeed. You know, Democrats want to get rid of loopholes that help Mitt Romney, loopholes that help hedge funds, carried interest, and the like. So you could say loophole and everyone cheers, and then you get to which loopholes, and we get to but the whole idea that the tax code needs to be simplified, and that totally is separate from, to me, progressive rates and all that kind of stuff. To me, you know, that's a different issue. But the idea that, of course, the tax code is too complicated and needs to be simplified, I think is a good one. Ronald Reagan did it in 86. It's one of the few things that I like that Ronald Reagan did.
He just didn't go far enough.
Well, that's right. That's one thing, interestingly, that I think we could all agree on. I don't think it's going to happen before Christmas. But I think in the next year that is something that both Democrats and Republicans should commit to and work really hard on. Go ahead, Michael.
Well, you know what also helps is you just mentioned about the media coverage. You know, some part of the media is really overhyping, which I will agree with you on, but then they're also not reporting significant aspects of this whole fiscal cliff. The thing that I'm happy about is that the poll stating that if we were to go over the edge, then the, much of the blame will be placed on Republicans.
Good point.
A high percentage on that. Well, I want to see
media
report more of is the stunt that Mitch McConnell pulled just yesterday, or on Friday, I should say, when he introduced the bill and Harry Reid, Senate Majority Leader, Democrat, looked it over, and he found that there's probably some stuff there that which would benefit the American people and would help us go over the cliff. So you bring it to the chamber, you bring it up to the floor for a vote, and who's the one that filibusters the bill? Mitch McConnell.
Yeah, he filibustered his own bill. That was actually a very interesting thing. Basically, I'll tell you what he did. He was calling the Democrats bluff, is how he put it. He said, well, the Democrats don't even support the president's plan. So Mitch McConnell, the leader of the Republicans, puts forward the Democrats' plan. The Democrats say, okay, we'll vote on it. We'll support it. And he's like, oh, wait, no, okay, never mind. And then he filibustered his own bill, which I'd never seen before.
I thought it was a bill that he crafted mainly for Republicans, but the way that he worded it, Harry Reid probably found something in there that would probably work good for the American people.
Now,
and then on and on is, we see how pretty much how Turtlehead is playing games with Congress and playing games with the American people, and this is why they lost big in 08, and especially in the recent election. They're going to keep losing as long as they want to keep playing games with people's livelihoods.
It also shows why we need filibuster reform. Go ahead, Terry.
Well, it's also, you know, we've got to realize, I mean, again, in terms of the dishonesty of this whole situation, which is what really concerns me and why I'm looking, kind of encouraged by having a very dramatic change that, that sort of shocks everybody with going down the slope, not the cliff. You know, the simple fact is that, you know, Medicare is already, you know, there are increases in rates going on. There's increases in taxes going on already. There's economic changes across the board that will affect the individual, and for the most part, mostly affect the middle class, that are already not only in the hopper, they've been passed, and they are going to be in effect in 2013 and in 2014. So there's all this sort of subterfuge about what is going on with our individual economy and our individual tax and Medicare, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And nobody seems to even be aware of these changes or talking about them.
I wonder how many Americans are even aware that the Social Security age is already going up from 65 to 67. I won't get Social Security until I'm 67.
This is crucial. The whole point, there's two main things here that are trying to happen. The Republicans, one, and the financial industry wants to get hold of America's retirement and America's pensions. That's
sure
what's really
do.
Driving a whole lot of this. They want control of that pension money. The other thing that is such a lie is about this aging and raising the age rate for Social Security because of a life expectancy is greater. Life expectancy is greater only, and this is a fact, is only greater amongst the rich, the wealthy. The average person, certainly the average laborer, does not have an increased lifespan. It's the elite, it's the 1%, and probably the 20%, that have an increased lifespan. So all that is doing, when it's raised to 67, is punishing those people who do manual labor, who do physical labor, who have less money for health care to begin with, and not really solving the problem at all.
Take a look at a coal miner, someone who works hard in West Virginia or Pennsylvania. Talk about back-breaking work, 12, 14 hours a day with no sunlight, underground, risking your life every moment, breathing in all that dust that gets into your lungs and ends up killing you anyway. And a lot of those coal factories, they don't have unionized labor. They fight very hard against unions, and so the people don't have health care. It's very hard to live much longer than 65 if you're a coal miner. Let's face it, you come from a poor community. A lot of times that those are the only jobs available in that community. That's one job I guarantee you that I never, ever want to have. Listen, I'm not attacking the worker. My God, if anything, I'm praising the worker for going through what they go through. I'm attacking the employer for their conditions being so awful. But people like that, they definitely need their retirement. And the thing that really gets me is the people who want to raise Medicare to 67. That would be atrocious. We already have a problem with people needing health care who are under 65, 64, 63, heck, even 45 and 55. or 25. If you get cancer and you're 25 years old, you want health care. Well, that's a real problem, a major problem in America. And to go in the other direction and to take away health care for people who are 65 or 66, frankly, it would cost, first of all, it would cost the government a huge fortune anyway, because we have to provide with them with Medicaid and Obamacare and all the other ways. They wouldn't pay premiums in the Medicare system. It wouldn't help the solvency of the system hardly at all. What it would do is bring more people out from under the protection of health care. So we have to be very, very careful with these entitlements.
Even with what is in place now, I mean, this is a fact that I just have right before me right now. They just read, and thank heavens it's in some papers. People should be aware of it. And I quote, and this is by the Associated Press, a 65-year-old couple retiring this year is estimated to need approximately $240,000 to cover medical expenses throughout retirement.
Wow.
The average savings of the average person is around $50,000.
Yep.
Obviously, we have a problem here. And Medicare does not cover everything. It covers a good percentage, but it does not cover everything, and it will not take care of the health care needs. And people are just not being told not only the truth economically, they're not being told the truth about what's going on with health care, because we still don't have anything like universal health care in this country.
You know what else is important here? Since they kept on raising the age, particularly with Social Security and retirement from 65 to 67, this has got to be addressed, because what is next? They're going to try to push up to 70 and then to 75. I mean, this is pretty much crap, and you'd be forcing the people to be working forever until the day they die, and then, wow, the government or we, the Republicans, don't have to pay out the Social Security anymore.
I wish
people would see what is going on here and tell them, enough is
enough. Enough is enough. Hey, Michael, hang on, if you want, into the inside scoop, but that's the end of the Raucous Caucus. I want to thank you, Terry, for being here. Terry and I are here every week on Sunday on We Act Radio from noon to one. You can hear our raucousness, and we're sorry. I should say that Garland Nixon, unfortunately, is unable to join us, but some days he's told us he will. So we hope he will call in and be part of the old Raucous Caucus. But either way, Terry and I certainly have enough disagreement among us.
Yes, we do, and our listeners should remember, you cannot kill the Raucous Caucus.
No!
It will be with you forever.
No, it's like a cockroach in the middle of nuclear war.
That's not pretty.
We will not go. Hey, Terry, people need to find you. How do they do that?
Dr. of Democracy at AOL.com. Dr. of Democracy at AOL.com.
That's right. My website's marklevinetalk.com. My Twitter name is @marklevinetalk. Thank you, Terry, for coming on. I'll see you next week.
You will indeed. Bye bye.
Okay.
Take care, Terry.
All right. So I'll tell you what, we're going to end the Raucous Caucus. We'll come back with more of the Inside Scoop. Coming up on the Inside Scoop, I want to focus on what's going on in the Middle East. And there's a whole bunch going on in the Middle East. In Syria, of course, the civil war continues there. The rebels looks like they might take over. A dramatic reversal by the president of Egypt, Morsi. And what is Obama's role in the Arab Spring? How do we stop all these people from dying? What's going on there? And I also, and I'm going to do this when I come back at the top of the show, I have a dramatic announcement regarding Congressman Barney Frank and his appearance at We Act Radio. I'm going to give you all the details when we come back after the break. Coming up is the Inside Scoop. We'll be right back right after this.